This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Sari Nusseibeh. He's president of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. I spoke with him on March 15th, 2011, at his office in East Jerusalem. This interview is included in our show, The Evolution of Change. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org. Good to see you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you rolling?
Seated and well placed.
That's right, and I can't move now.
Yeah.
You know, we have a common friend in Paul Eli, at your editor.
Oh, yes, Paul Eli.
And I wrote to him after I finished reading the book, and I said, I said, what a beautiful, important book. I'm so glad you brought this out.
Yeah. Did you see the new book that came out?
Once Upon a Country?
No. What's the Palestinian State Worth? Which is Harvard University Press.
I did see that. Paul didn't do that one, though,
did he? No, not Paul.
Yeah.
An equally charming person. The editor is Sharmila Sen at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who worked with me very closely is Camille Smith.
Camille Smith.
She works as an editor.
Mm-hmm. And I also interviewed Rabbi David Hartman, who mentioned you, and
many,
I noticed that you
ago,
mentioned
yes,
him
yes,
also
yes.
in your book.
We met many years ago,
and
had a joint sort of program in the American colony, I remember.
Oh. Yeah, he mentioned some of your conversations.
Yeah, it's a long time since I've seen him.
Yeah. So, what do you need, Chris? Do you need sound check?
Yeah, just a little more
I don't want you to say anything profound, and so I'm afraid. So what did you have for lunch?
What did I have for lunch?
Yes.
Well, some profound things.
Okay.
It was a mixture of lunch and breakfast, actually. You know, we had the normal stuff that people eat around here, hummus and fool and tomatoes and eggs and za'atar. You know za'atar?
Za'atar?
The sort of herb that you...
With the sesame seeds.
With tiny sesame seeds. Mm-hmm. And of course, you use kayak to dip everything.
Oh, I like that
to
idea.
To eat. Kayak is like bread, or it's an alternative form of bread.
Yes.
And people say, although this is very profound, actually, to be making such a statement, that the kayak that's produced, cooked in Jerusalem, is actually the best kayak you can find in the Arab world. But this may have been true in the past. It's no longer true.
It's just
a fiction of people's minds and imagination.
Okay. All right.
Can I just...
All right. You may begin to be profound. No. yes, take some water. I will too. Well, I'm really thrilled to be here and honored to be here.
Well,
and
great. Thank you.
We have a program. Do you know anything about our program?
No, I was just reading. You know, I don't listen to the programs in America.
This is U.S. public radio, right? It's our equivalent of the BBC. It's not the BBC, but it's the closest thing we have.
Oh, it's not? Mm-hmm. Oh.
Not quite. It doesn't have that history and that reach. But our focus of this program is religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas, I think, and questions. When we talk about religion so much, we talk about competing answers and not the great searching questions.
Yeah.
So that's, and I, you know, philosophers are very much at home with our program too.
Yeah.
So, and I wanted to start out a little bit with, you know, who you are, which is fascinating. Your story is fascinating. You know, the fact that you are from the oldest, I want to make sure this is the oldest recognized family in Jerusalem, dating back 1,400 years. Is that...
Well, that's the myth.
That's the myth, right.
It's a myth that the family enjoys spreading around.
I mean, I was also fascinated, and I'm pretty sure I read this in your book, that the Nusseibeh family grew from a female tribal leader, from a woman,
That's right.
Who was among Muhammad's earliest followers?
That's right. She was one of the companions, actually, not just a follower. Mm-hmm. So when Muhammad made the first journey from Mecca to Medina, which is the Hijra, which marks the beginning of the era for the Muslims, as you know, he made this trip, you know, the Mecca people drove him out.
Right.
From Mecca, and he went to Medina. There in Medina, he was met by a few leaders of tribes mm-hmm. in Medina. And among them, I think there were four or three women or two women. And one of them was Nusayba, who belonged to one of the major tribes in Medina, who had originally come from the Yemen.
Really?
So it's a long story. And yeah. She later fought with him in the various battles and lost her kids, apparently, mm. according to the story we like to market. And I think even, you know, defended him with her body mm. on various occasions. You know, he was going to be, and as a result, lost some of her own limbs. And it is said that he asked her, you know, just tell me what you want. Because you have a free kind of open door for anything that you may wish for, ask for mm-hmm. from God. And she just asked that she and her children and her, you know, people after her would all just have a reasonably decent life, which I'm glad to report we are having.
You are evidence that that may have come true.
That's right. Uh-huh. But her two children, her two boys were killed in that battle, in those battles, one of the major battles. And then a cousin of hers, by the name of Ubadah, who was another of the Prophet's companions, came to Jerusalem with the earliest Muslim entry into Jerusalem and was appointed the first high judge, what was called the high judge at the time, of Jerusalem. And I think it is from there that we as a family went on dealing from that point on with the key to the Holy Sepulchre.
Right, became the holders of the Muslim that, family.
Yes, as you know, Bishop Sophronius at the time handed over the keys of Jerusalem to the to the Muslim army, or the Muslim caliph, supposedly Caliph Umar, who came to Jerusalem with his friends. Companions, and my suspicion is that this symbolic key, which was the key of the holy sites of the Christians,
the holy sites.
I think it was yes, because in the books, in the literature, it says you know the key to Jerusalem, but as you know, Jerusalem has many doors, gates,
right.
So it can't have been, you know, he couldn't have handed him seven keys.
And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is really that Christian center of Jerusalem.
And it's the center of life and the world as far as Christianity is concerned, and therefore, you know, a lot of world ideology is concerned, I mm-hmm. suppose. And, you know, if you go into the Holy Sepulchre, some of them will point to you to the exact point where the center of the earth is,
right.
Just as you go in. So clearly it's a very important location. And I imagine that the judge was given the key to look after the church, this holiest of sites, to protect it. And I imagine this is how we came to be to have anything to do with the key to the sepulchre. Although, of course, there are many other stories. And one of the other stories is that the various Christian churches often fight with each other, and they had to go outside for a
and they needed a neutral,
and so they came to us. But today, I must add that today, for the last 400-500 years, the responsibility has been shared between two families,
okay.
And they're both Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
One, the job of opening and closing the gate or door, and the other, the job of actually keeping the key at safely mm-hmm. during the night.
I think for an American, what's so astonishing about that story is not that it happened, but that the tradition has been maintained for century after century.
Yes, it is actually even astonishing here because, but you must realize that the Holy Sepulchre is really a maze of traditions
mm-hmm.
that have been maintained, guarded, sometimes to the point of friction between various people.
Between the Christians.
Between the Christians mostly. Although, mm-hmm. of course, as you also probably know, many years ago, there was one Muslim caliph from Egypt who went mad and ordered the burning of the sepulchre.
No.
And that was one of the reasons, in fact, back in the Middle Ages, which prompted, it seems, what says, sounds, I mean, maybe this that prompted the beginning of the Crusades.
I didn't know that.
Well, it's a story. It's he's a caliph from a Fatimid, belonging to the Fatimid era. And it is said that he ordered the burning, and it is true that the sepulchre was burnt. It was pulled down, and then the Crusades took place, as you know, and then Salahuddin came and regained it, and regained the traditions. And the Ottomans, you know, maintained what is called the status quo in the church, and indeed in the entire Holy Land. The status quo being the balance that exists, the traditional balance that exists between the various churches and the various locations. So who has control of what, you know, which church has which particular bit, which chair a priest can sit on, which door can be opened by whom, at what time of the day or night.
When the different groups worship.
When the different groups worship.
So tell me also about your Muslim identity. What was the Muslim sensibility that you grew up in your family?
Let me tell you. I mean, it's a bit complicated. Perhaps, special, maybe is the word to use here. Because on my father is a very open-minded person, you know, liberal, educated in the West, and so on. My mother, on the other hand, comes from a very conservative Muslim family, and indeed. Some of her ancestors are supposed to have been Sufi.
Wasn't her father?
Not her father. Her father was very religious. He was deeply religious. But he was also a businessman, her father, a kind of farmer, who at one stage was also a political activist. He was picked up by the British and he was expelled from the country by them to a place I'd like to be expelled to today, which is Seychelles. But at the time, it was a horrible place, apparently, to be expelled to. And there were about four or five of them who were the leaders of the Palestinian resistance to what was happening. And he was also religious, but he comes himself from a family. I mean, his ancestors are religious. And indeed, today, he is buried next to a religious Sufi master in Ramleh. Where he in fact died, where he passed away. But so she is more religious. I mean, she comes from a more religious kind of background, and so different from my father. And although my father was also religious, but he wasn't a kind of mystical religious person. My mother was more inclined to be mystical religious person. And so I grew up in between them, and both of them had great admiration and taught us to have great admiration for, you know, the fact that we were, as a family, custodians or keyholders of the Holy Sepulchre. And we grew up to, in fact, respect the holidays, religious holidays of Christians. I didn't know the difference between the various Christian groups. I just thought at the time when I was young that they were just, you know, beautiful ways to be different. And every time there was some kind of occasion and festivity for one group or another, we just went and as kids and joined in it, thinking, you know, Christians have a nicer time than Muslims because there's so many festivals, you know, being held by so many different colored groups. And I think that's how it was. We didn't notice any friction as children between the various groups.
Was there less friction, or you just weren't aware of it?
I don't think there was really as such. I mean, every now and again, maybe you'd hear about some kind of quarrel that broke out. But as I grew up in the context of the sepulchre and the festivities and so on, I never really heard of any frictions between the various religious groups. And on the contrary, I didn't even make any, you know, the distinctions weren't really there in my mind. You know, the Copts and the Armenians and the, I don't know, Orthodox
Greeks,
and the Greeks.
Yeah.
And it wasn't there. And so we just grew up actually celebrating with the various Christian groups.
There was something quite beautiful you wrote about your mother. You said, whatever the source, The Islam she inculcated in us was a religion with minimal miracles and a cornucopia of rock-solid humanistic values. For her, Islam taught dignity, honesty, self-worth, simplicity, kindness, and, of course, love, endless love.
Endless love. Mm-hmm. Well, I think she's down to earth as a person, as a human being, and that's where her belief in the mystical aspect of religion, I suppose, connects. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my father was more of an intellectual.
And he was very passionate about pan-Arabic causes.
He wasn't
right?
passionate. I wouldn't say he was very passionate, but he was more of an intellectual. I mean, mm-hmm. he looked at life in intellectual with intellectual spectacles. Mm-hmm. And analyzed what was happening in those terms. Certainly he had a great deal of pride in his Arabness, I think. You know, and in a way that didn't, in fact, reveal itself to anyone who knew him at first. You know, people didn't realize that he was such a proud Arab. But he was very proud as an Arab. He was proud of his Arabness. He knew a lot of poetry, pre-Islamic poetry. And you know, he had a lot of those talents. Very clever, visionary, imaginative. And so on, but he did not, for instance, write poetry, which is what my mother did.
Well, she came from a long line of Sufis, right?
That's right. So my mother was into that. A lot of, as I say, love. And she exhibited and showed this love. My father was a bit deferential. He was sort of distant. I think the first child he ever held in his arms was my own child, but not his own children. Yeah. And that was when he was already in his 60s or 70s. So yes, she was totally different, and first of all, she was very much of a human being. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me from your writing that your father's pan-Arabic vision also was very deeply humanistic and pluralistic, right? That he saw it as drawing out not just the best of Muslim virtues, yes, but also of those of the other traditions. Would
that's
that be right?
Right. His Arabness was, as you say, pluralistic. He did not see it as in any way conflicting with anything else. He saw the Arab world in terms of what it used to be, what he imagined maybe that it used to be in the past, namely as a big cauldron, you know, having everyone in it, mixed up, and everyone fulfilling themselves in it, culturally, linguistically, in every other way. And I think if he prided himself on his Arabness, it was insofar as he saw Arabness as something that contained all of this, that enabled this sort of mixture. Which
all
no
of those elements of humanity
of
and
humanity,
tradition that had gone into all the Arabic cultures?
In theory. I mean, you know, when one thinks of Arab culture in its heyday, one thinks of the fact that it is a culture that, you know, admitted of pluralism, a plurality of ideas, and so on. But it's not always been idyllic, of course. Mm-hmm. And very often, we must always recall or remember that it's had times and periods, and especially now, for instance, where this is not at all true of it. But whenever you find that an Arab is or does feel proud of that culture, it is on account of that particular era,
right,
real or imagined, which, in fact, held all this variety, in which, you know, people who would be religious as well as people who would be anti-religious would be tolerated. People who were, you know, Armenian or Kazakh or whatever would be very much part of it, in which Jews, for instance, constituted a major component of it. You know, right up to, I think, even 67, my father still held out hope for bringing this back again, this kind of open vision of an open Arab society in which Jews and others would be very much part of the world that he imagined the Arab world really in its true nature reflected.
Mm-hmm. And you know, your account of how you experienced 1967 is quite different from, I don't know, the telling that I think comes down. I mean, you describe how you had been, you were on the West Bank, where you'd been part of the West Bank, right? You grew up in land which was controlled by Jordan. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you were Israeli, And this didn't feel wrong to you. And you, I mean, you describe going into what had been no man's land. There's a new freedom in your telling of that personal experience.
I was never Israeli, and I'm not Israeli.
Right, you're not Israeli.
But anyway.
Right, so that's like, forgive me.
But land that had been
Jordan and now is Israel.
But you're right. I mean, what happened was this, that I grew up, our house was right on the edge of no man's land.
Okay.
And right across, you know, on the end of the garden, we had something called Mandelbaum Gate. And Mandelbaum Gate was a gate through which either visitors, diplomats, or sometimes on occasion, Christians would be allowed to pass from Israel to Jordan, okay, especially during religious occasions. Now, in that kind of situation, I would look across towards the west, and right there in front of me, I saw the edge of what was Israel. And the edge of what was Israel at the time was what is now known as Mea Shearim, or the religious Israeli-Jewish religious quarter. And it's a quarter which is inhabited by people who wear religious clothes, you know, the black costumes. And therefore, as I grew up, and I would stand at the end of the garden and look across at Israel, what I would see, and the image that was depicted in my mind, was that the Israeli was that person, the black person living in that quarter. And I could see them across the no man's land, which was totally empty, and I'd see them also looking at me as I grew up. But there was this piece of land between us, and in the middle there was an old building that had been destroyed in the war, in the 48 war. Apparently it was a courthouse, but it had been destroyed, and it was left destroyed for the 20 years during which I was growing up. Now this was the sight I had from the garden looking at Israel. And when I went inside the house to listen to what my father was talking about, what my mother was talking about, and you know, you can bet that all their talk was about the war and Israel and how it was before 1948 and 49, and you know, all about the life that they had on the other side, within, you know, behind that line which I could see outside. There I imagined a paradise, because this is the story that was, you know, conveyed to us, that it was paradise, you know, orange groves, beautiful houses, beautiful life. And so paradise was there, but what I could see was the edge of those evil people that had stolen it, stolen paradise, and stolen the moment of paradise from my parents. And it was a sort of a contradiction that was there in my mind between the surface and the inside. And so in 1967, now I wasn't here, I was abroad, and I asked to come back, and I did come back, and it was
you
strange.
You were in Cambridge,
I was in England. Mm-hmm. I still hadn't yet got into Oxford, but I did later, but it was a time when I was still at high school. And then I took a plane and came back, and it was the first time for me to come into the country, sort of, you know, on an Israeli airplane and coming due east, so to speak, and landing in Lod Airport, which, you know, was the paradise, and on land which I assumed and was told was, you know, belonged to me by right, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean to me as a Palestinian, but even to me as a person who has inherited bits of property in that area as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a personal thing as well. So it was for me a very peculiar kind of experience. And then driving back into Jerusalem for the first time, driving back, going due east, which is very strange, and then coming finally to our house, which was at the edge. Now, you know, the following day after I arrived, or 2 days later, I went back again to the garden and again looked across at the other side, and then decided to do what I had always been dreaming of doing, which was to just make a crossing, to cross that distance by foot. And so I jumped over, you know, to no man's land, and I started walking, you know, step by step. And the first thing I did was to go to the old building and a vineyard, a grapevine that was growing there. I'd always seen it there. And the grapes weren't good because, you know, nobody had looked after them. Anyway, it wasn't their season. But, you know, it was nice actually being able to touch it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I took various steps, several steps, and then I'd stop and then look back. And then I'd try to imagine. I just wanted to see what I looked like from the other side.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went on with this journey until I got to the other side, to the street that I always saw, where the Jews that I always saw, the religious Jews, would stand looking at us and sort of pointing at us about 100 meters away or 150 meters away. And I tried just to put myself in their shoes and try to imagine what we must have looked like and what I, as a little kid or child, must have seemed like to them. And I, you know, to me it was a very important journey, this crossing of no man's land. Mm-hmm. And I used it in the book, but I use it also very often to explain the this journey that I feel that we all need to cross. I mean, okay, not all of us, meaning Palestinians or Israelis, but all of us in general, the journey that one always has to cross from being oneself to being the other, and to try and see oneself through the eyes of the other in order to bridge the distance between people. I mean, I think this is a journey that has had a major impact on me.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've been here 4 or 5 days, and we did a couple of programs a few years ago, which we called Two Narratives. Mm-hmm. We had Palestinian and Israeli voices, and I think as soon as we'd been here about 2 days, we realized that there's so many more than two narratives. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just that there are multiple Israeli mm-hmm. narratives, multiple Palestinian narratives, multiple Christian, Jewish, and Muslim mm-hmm. narratives. And then I think, you know, then there are the personal narratives. And, mm-hmm. and I think that what I also got out of your writing, out of your family's history, is this, in all those layers, there's also a layer of legend.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's the imagined, which also affects the reality, and I don't know. I just
much of reality maybe is imagined. I mean, when you speak about the narratives that you speak about, and the fact that there's so many of them, you're basically saying, I think, that reality is very complex,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just one thing, and it is constituted by the different ways that it is seen or perceived or experienced, and different people see and perceive and experience it in different ways. And I think one has always to be aware of that. So there's no one thing which is out there, which is reality, and another thing which is the subject, us looking at reality.
Mm-hmm. But here, each of the narratives, or many of them, have such a weight of history and also of trauma behind them, right? So.
Yes, and some of it you're saying is legend, but I think even the history and the trauma and the legend are all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And not to belittle the trauma, but I think that the pain that people remember or recall, very much of it was also slowly constructed, maybe created, and maybe made to look worse than it was or is. And insofar as it is made to be worse than it is actually worse. Mm-hmm. It becomes worse. It's experienced as worse, even in retrospect. And so, I'd say that things sort of fade into one another. I'm not sure that I would separate or distinguish between the human experience and the object experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were both sort of mixed up with each other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, here's something you wrote about Israelis and Palestinians, or Jews and Arabs. You said, in two strangers, each driven by fear and terror, totally unaware of the condition of the other, the Jew seeks space to continue living, mm-hmm. which the Arab defends, while the Arab defends his space to the death. And that's one way of...
Well, that's a narrative. I mean, that's two narratives.
Yeah.
So when that particular image was invoked, I also invoked the image of the in the same passage or page, I think, the Jew, what I call the jumping Jew, sort of jumping from the airplane, running away from the Holocaust, and parachuting down, so to speak, with a
oh yes,
with a holding a gun in his hand, a machine gun because, you know, he's scared. And he's just jumped out of the fire, so to speak. And he wants to search for space or for salvation, for defending himself. And then, you know, I imagine my grandfather, I mean, it's an imaginative, imaginary kind of grandfather there, as a farmer, because he wasn't
Didn't you present this scenario in a conversation with your father or your grandfather?
My mother.
Your mother, all right.
Yes. So, I asked her, you know, what would you have said if instead of this kind of scenario, as I've just portrayed it, where there is this jumping, you know, parachuting Jew with a machine gun in his hand, who suddenly alerts my grandfather, who's a farmer, mm-hmm. and he's holding a plow in his hand, and he hears this voice, and he looks up, and he sees this thing coming down on him, and he's never seen an aeroplane in his life, never mind a parachute, you know, or forget about a machine gun and things, and he's scared, and he, you know, pulls up the plow to defend himself, mm-hmm. and this guy who's parachuting down is himself scared, mm-hmm. and he sees this, you know, Arab garb person also with a plow raised, and he is frightened. And it's a kind of combined fear. And it's fear that neither side understands or appreciates, because that, you know, when people are afraid, they're too afraid for themselves,
right,
to be aware or conscious of the fear that they cause in others. And it's, in a sense, I said, this fear, this that seems to be constantly simmering and feeding the conflict that continues between Israel and Palestine. So I went to my mother and asked her, what if, you know, instead of this kind of situation, you know, a rabbi, a very wise old rabbi, came along and knocked on your grandfather's door and asked, you know, and told him of this impending, the signs of an impending Holocaust, of anti-Semitism, and therefore of an impending Holocaust, and the need, therefore, that Jews have in Europe to find a safe home, and that they decided that this being an ancestral, historical home would, you know, suit them, and, you know, realizing that there are Arabs there, could they share it with them? Could the Arabs here actually open the door, mm-hmm. for them? What would your father have said? And her immediate answer was, you know, don't be, who do you think we are, you know? Of course he would have said, you're most welcome. I mean, she spoke as a kind of, in a very hospitable kind of
way. And also, your mother is someone who had a great deal of resentment towards...
Extreme resentment.
Yes.
I mean, she's very passionate about this, because her childhood was lost, her father, you know, was expelled, he finally died when he was young, their property was burnt by the British, mm-hmm. her husband, my father, lost a leg in the war. She lost him, actually, in a sense, also because all his life he was involved in politics, so she's very resentful of the conflict in general, mm-hmm. but of the Israelis having caused it, mm-hmm. in particular. So, but at the same time, you know, she is a humanist. And very open-minded. And, you know, when I put to her that particular scenario, this was her immediate response, very spontaneous, which confirmed to me what I always knew about a person of her with her qualities, that they would be above all human beings in the way that they looked at themselves and at others. In spite of the pain even because of the pain mm-hmm. people go through. And pain is different from fear. I mean, if you are just in pain, you can also somehow sympathize with other people's pain. Fear is different, I think.
So I want to ask you, I mean, you have this vast history. You have been for a time the head of the PLO in Jerusalem for a few years.
Well, for a year and a half, I filled in a post as a PLO person. But yes, I was involved with Fatah and PLO mm-hmm. for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So here's a large question I want to ask you. You know, what Palestinian stories are not being told? What qualities of the Palestinian people get lost in the headlines that make their way out of this part of the world?
The gentleness of Palestinians, the kindness and gentleness of pastoral Palestinian life, mm. which is actually getting lost not only in stories and headlines, but in reality. I mean, I think that even during the past 30 years that I've been here working, I mean, you know, I came back to start working, and right at the beginning when I came back, I could still sense the what I called just now the pastoral kindness and openness of Palestinian of the Palestinian character. And I think over time, over these 30 years, this has totally disappeared. And you know, what I now see around me is a quality. I do not see that the Palestinian has qualities that somehow differentiate him or her from being an Israeli or an Egyptian or anything else. Before, I used to somehow have the sense or feeling that we were different, that we were kinder, more hospitable, gentler, tolerant, much more tolerant, pluralistic by nature. I think we are far more pluralistic. I mean, to go back to my own upbringing and the openness of my being both a Muslim and having Christianity right in the middle of my own house, in at more than one level. My having been brought up in a Christian school, a missionary school, that my parents, who are Muslims, very Muslim, you know, would send me to, made, you know, was a reflection of a kind of openness of society that does no longer exist, I'm afraid, at the moment.
And has that, do you feel, has that been beaten out of people by the conflict,
By the conflict,
conditions.
Yes, by the conditions of conflict, by the continuity, the challenge, the challenges they've had to put up with, you know, political, economic, social, demographic, everything has changed, transformed, revolutionized in their lives in ways, some of them positive, but on the whole, making them lose that quality, you know, that I associate always with, you know, with olive trees and solidarity and countryside solidarity and nice gatherings and evening gatherings people used to have, where people would tell stories, you know, the old would tell the young stories, you know, that came from 100 and 200 and 300 years ago. This was very much part of a peaceful culture we had that I grew up with, I was aware of, that has now totally disappeared and, you know, has become replaced by politics, Hamas, right. Fatah, PLO, Israel, you know, Netanyahu,
So where
Arafat.
Do you look at that and through that? I mean, where does your hope lie now? Or how do you try to imagine restoration of that or healing or a new reality?
I think healing is important. I'm not sure how long it'll take. I still feel that hope. I still not feel. I have a gut sort of faith in the fact that things will somehow righten themselves. Will eventually come back together. I'm not sure that we will be able to replicate what we had. But I think that with awareness, alertness to what we lost, to the good things that we lost and the bad things that we've acquired, and the ability to distinguish between the good and the bad, eventually we'll be able to create a new future with better, you know, with more things that are good. Necessarily the same.
What would bring that about? I mean, what conditions would need to be in place for that to happen?
Well, I mean, we'd have to somehow, the politics, I think we'd have to find a way to resolve the politics. And, you know, resolving the politics is something that's not impossible. And I think it's something that's happening anyway. It's not necessarily happening in the way that people assume it is happening. It's not happening in the sense of, you know, reading the headlines that there's a solution and it's been signed by the two parties, but it's happening, it seems to me, it's unfolding slowly. In the sense that people on both sides are more and more aware of the fact that living in conflict is intolerable, and that, you know, there is a way to find, there is a way that can be found, which would allow the two sides to live together. Now, what way is not clear in my mind. For some time it was two states. Perhaps in the future it could be a federation of regions, of city-states, of entire. I'm not sure how it will look, but I think in general, people are slowly maturing, if you like, to the need to put life and the values of life as human beings above the not in place of, but above perhaps the more limiting aspects of self-identity and identification of themselves as being Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Arab or, you know, from this town or from that and so on and so forth.
So, I mean, one thing you're saying, let's say to Americans, is don't just, the only barometer of whether change is possible or change is happening is not whether there's an active peace process or not, right? Or as you say, whether agreements, new agreements have been signed. But I mean, what do you think of? What comes to your mind and your imagination when you talk about people maturing? I mean, are there examples of individuals or communities or initiatives that are just bubbling along in civil society?
Yes, I mean, look. I mean, there's been a look. There's in general, if you sort of compare between the attitudes of Israelis and Palestinians towards each other, 50 years ago, say, and today, you'll find, you know, we've gone through a sea change. Now, it's not been perceptible on a day-by-day basis, but if you make the comparison between those two periods, you realize that we've covered a long, long, long distance. And if you ask people on the whole today, for instance, about a two-state solution, I think even my mother would tell you, you know, I'm happy with a two-state solution, but it would have to be one to which also the other side would agree to. This is my mother's condition.
Yeah.
And I think it's the condition that's probably put by most Israelis and most Palestinians. You know, they're happy to come to a solution on condition that the other side is also willing to come to that particular solution.
Right.
And I think this attitude is new. I mean, it's open. It's sort of basically saying we are prepared to live at peace. We do not wish to continue living at war. And that's, I think, what's most important. Now, this is the general umbrella, the general address. Then you look underneath and you'll see that, you know, people behave as ordinary individuals in many walks of life. And especially, you know, even between 67 and 87, those 20 years, initial 20 years of occupation, have been actually 20 years in which or during which a lot of Arabs, Palestinians, have became, you know, accustomed to Israelis, and in which also the Israelis came to be aware of and accustomed to living with Arabs. You know, villages, towns in the West Bank were or would have been filled with Israeli shoppers, say on Saturdays and Fridays and so on. And Israel itself was filled with people working from Gaza in the West Bank. It was totally different from today what things are like.
Right, and it's gone back
on the surface because of the failure of this particular peace effort, which everybody tried to put together. So
are you talking about Oslo or since Oslo?
Oslo.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, then, you know, the second intifada.
I mean, this whole thing of Oslo, or Madrid, if you like, leading to Oslo, and opening up the hope that, you know, this is it, and then people discovering on both sides, no, it is not it.
Right.
Okay, so people have decided this is not it, and they're angry and frustrated, and they are expressing this, and they've been expressing this for the past 10 or 15 years in different ways, many of them being ugly ways. But this does not change from the underlying fact that both sides realize that this is the right road, I think. And
that the direction is right.
Mm-hmm. That this was a, you know, okay, there's a mistake, there's a problem here, but it has to be solved. And I think people can look at this way.
You know, I think also there's a different imagination of, there's a different sense of time here.
Mm-hmm.
Even while people living their daily lives, they want their children to have to be healthy and happy and fed and schooled that day, right? But you don't see this, and I've had this in conversation with Israelis also, this there's a sense here that history is long. And, you know, for example, when we were getting our tour of the Old City the other day, and we had a Palestinian Christian tour guide, He was telling us about one of those many places looking out over Jerusalem, which was Christian and then Muslim, and maybe it's Christian again, right? And he said, in one of these places, he said, and then the Crusaders were there, but they were only there for 200 years, so they couldn't do much. And yeah. I mean, I think that also, so again, when Americans look at this conflict, they feel like it, you know, we have to resolve it this year or next year.
Yeah.
And you have it, but what you're describing is a sense that there's change, but that it may be the work of generations also, I mean.
Oh, absolutely. But I think because what we're looking at is not an agreement that's a kind of a sales agreement or a, you know, it's not a surface agreement.
Right.
What we're looking at is something much more fundamental. We're looking at how human beings evolve. And we're not looking at how human beings evolve only in this part of the world. This is part of you know, the entire experience. I mean, everybody, including Americans, are part of this very slow process of human maturation. And by this, I mean the process through which or by which people come to see each other in the kind of right proportion they should be seeing each other, as opposed to the skewed proportion that they, you know, sometimes are made to see each other.
Especially when they're fearful.
Especially when they're fearful. But also when they are, you know, brought up, engineered socially, educationally to think in specific ways, mm-hmm. thinking that this is, you know, this is the right thing to do for ourselves. And so I think people are, on the whole, certainly here, but elsewhere, are evolving, maturing. And this maturation process is necessary condition to come back to here, in particular, a necessary condition for resolving our particular conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, because it's long-standing. You know, Jews, Abraham, Isaac, Mecca, I don't know what. I mean, it's not something that happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And so it can't just be resolved. And you know, you speak about legends and myths, and you have to somehow grow into them, grow out of them, know how to deal with them, live peaceably at them, while at the same time accepting other myths that may conflict with them.
Mm.
And but I think it's happening. It's a process of maturation. And I think what we need to do, while we have not yet signed on a proper sort of legal document, making peace between the two sides, what people need to do is just to make life as bearable, tolerable as possible, and make sure that we are maturing in the right direction. Make sure, for instance, that we're educating ourselves in the right way. Make sure that, for instance, our children will not have to deal with the same problems that we've dealt with, that they can, in fact, go ahead, move ahead, and solve whatever remaining problems there are. Mm-hmm. But I think the process is there.
Hmm. We're going to change our tapes. I'll just ask you a few more questions. This is you tell me when you're ready. Okay, all right. You know, it's interesting to me that in your writing you've invoked as a Muslim, you've invoked the image of Christ and the spirit of Christ as one, a healing, potentially healing image for Palestinians.
Well, for more than one reason. I mean, one reason, of course, is that, and this is not being flippant, but we do look upon him as an ancient Palestinian.
Yes,
as a forefather. But the other reason is that, in fact, as a Palestinian also, we believe, I feel very much, that everywhere you look in this country, you sense his presence.
Hmm.
And you know, the more that you find out about his history, and the more that you find out about the different locations and so on and so forth, you cannot but feel, you know, that he's very much there. And finally, the message that he has, which is, I believe, extremely important, very significant, very important for us as Muslims and Jews in this part of the world, of love, of compassion, and really it's the only pure message of peace that exists for us. I mean, you know, we can always say that Muhammad also, you know, had the message of peace, or he was peaceful, and that Jews can probably say this about. But I think, you know, when you look at Christ was, you know, everything in peace. I mean, it was just peace. He was just a message of peace. Mm. And in that, I think there's a unique kind of important significance for us fighting in this particular region. And certainly I invoke him. I think it's very important to read stories about him, whether true or not.
As a Palestinian.
As a Palestinian, yes. but also in general. I mean, you know, you can't just, yes, as a Palestinian, it's necessary.
I mean, to read about him as a Palestinian.
Yes.
I'm very interested in this, also the rich network of web of relationships you've always had with Israelis. I would like for you to explain, and I want to talk about that. I do think you make an important point that I think I would like to understand better, that Israel tends to attack the moderates among the Palestinians and play to the fanatics. Explain that dynamic that you see.
In terms of
the response that's elicited by Palestinians.
Look, I mean, I realize this is controversial what I'm saying, but I think that it's also true that what we've had in Israel is the following. In general, I mean, and there are always, of course, exceptions and so on and so forth, but at the level of government, the sense that the best way to keep Israel going, to keep it strong, to keep it also growing, is to maintain the sense that the other side, the other, is dangerous and a threat. And therefore, whenever the other came up with a face or would come up with a face that didn't express this, this would be regarded by the government, say, as something not falling within its strategy, and would therefore undermine it, bringing up again the negative face or mm-hmm. image of the other. And therefore, of course, take for instance, I'll give you one example, the so-called three no's of Khartoum, just after 1967, the Arab countries got together in Sudan, had a meeting, and they produced, you know, they said, you know, do you want to recognize Israel? No. Do you want to have negotiations? No. Do you want to do this? No. And you know, this was the three no's of Khartoum.
Okay.
And then, you know, Israel made such a big thing of it. Look at the Arab world. No. Everything is no about the Arab world. And later, much later, recently, in about maybe 10 years ago, I can't remember, the Arab world came up with a peace plan. And the peace plan, you know, was, you know, we'll recognize Israel, negotiate with Israel. Maybe the Israelis, you know, need not necessarily agree with every bit and piece of it. But you know, there was a major peace initiative. Now, does it have the same kind of marketing or attention by the Israelis? No, it doesn't. It sort of gets swept aside. And Israel keeps saying, no, the Arabs are not serious. The Arabs are dangerous. They don't want us. Look at the happenings now in the Arab world. There are revolutions sweeping the Arab world. And they're democratic revolutions, basically. Tunisia, Egypt in particular. And what do you find in Israel? Israel, there's fear. You know, no, they're not. There's Qaeda, there's Hamas. There are, you know, all these guys that don't understand.
And you understand where those fears come from, but you're also saying that they can become a way of seeing the world that then doesn't allow, that then
right.
masks another reality, another
That's
possibility.
Right. That's right. You sort of, you eventually become a victim. I mean, you sort of, you start out painting the other in a certain light. And, you know, at first it is perhaps a conscious act done out of strategy, because you are afraid and so you want to keep going, and so that's what you have to do. And so you do that. But then eventually you become a victim of it and you begin believing it. And so whenever something else happens, you know, whenever, for instance, the face of peace appears, you disbelieve it because you've, you know, educated yourself not to believe it.
You know, I was with someone I very much admire, a Jewish thinker, an Israeli thinker, and we were at dinner with him and his son. And he's a Holocaust survivor. His father was a Holocaust survivor, and he's got all that history in him. And his son just got back from his service in the army, 3 years in a tank in Gaza. It's very interesting, the difference in their reactions to Egypt.
Mm.
The father, as you were describing, just fearful, saying too much has happened. It would be not disallowing the possibility that perhaps, you know, it might be that this would lead someday to something positive, but basically saying we've experienced too much to just embrace this, right? Mm. The son saying, this is too amazing not to embrace. Mm. And he even said, even if this turns out not to flourish, this moment is amazing. And we, and he said, he was using English, and I think he was said, we the West and Israelis must hug them. I think he meant embrace, right?
Yeah.
And do what we can to turn this, to make all the positives of this be realized.
Yeah. Well, this is a generation gap.
Yeah, I'm wondering about you and you and your students and yeah. you have children.
Well, in my case, I have children, but in my case, I'm more, you know, I belong to the younger generation. In my attitude.
So tell me about that. Tell me about that. That yeah, you and your students and your children. How is this being received here?
No, I mean students and the children. My children, grown up, are all for what's happening, and you know, like the father and the son, even you know, maybe things will not quite. Unfold the way we wish them to in ideal terms. But nonetheless, I think we all see eye to eye that this is a magical moment mm-hmm. in our history, not just the history of the Arab people, in the history of humanity, I think. It's a moment, a magical moment in the sense of giving everyone hope that human beings, normal people, are in fact capable of determining their destinies peacefully, if they just stand up and say, this is what we want. Now, of course, you know, we see Gaddafi and what he does to them.
Right.
But nonetheless, and you know, we may see things not unfolding in the right way afterwards, but it is this moment that has to be embraced, the fact that this is possible. It's incredible. It's you know, they've used the term Arab awakening. I saw an article recently by Richard Haass saying...
He's the head of the Council on Foreign Relations.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And quite a hawk,
and
traditionally.
Quite a hawk.
Yes.
And he says, the Arabs sometimes speak of the Arab awakening as having occurred after, you know, with the Ottomans, with the fall down of the Ottoman Empire. But this may be a second Arab awakening. And I think... In a sense, it is true that this is an Arab awakening, a second Arab awakening. I wouldn't call the first one an Arab awakening,
okay.
But the Ottoman thing. But this one is a genuine Arab awakening because it is the people. It's not just rulers or governments. It is the ordinary people who've come out into the streets. And on the whole, you know, you'll find that the Palestinians are, you know, old or young, especially those that are not or do not have vested interests in the authority. Or in authority, mm-hmm. Are very much in favor of it. But of course, as the father that you mentioned said, you know, we're not sure what's going to happen.
Right.
But it is a moment, and I think that it is a moment that tells us that things are possible. That things are possible. That we're not under the threat, under the we are not captives or victims eternally mm-hmm. to the powers of evil.
It is kind of a demonstration of your thesis that there is a process of maturing.
It is a,
that there's
it is
an evolutionary human process.
Definitely. And it is, you know, I was giving some lectures recently. There's you see, something very strange happened. On the Arab intellectual front, so to speak, there's been debates ever since, you know, for the last 100 years about what theories should the Arab world embrace in order to jumpstart the Arab world into modernity. Should we, you know, go back, stick to the Islamic tradition? Should we become westernized? And people have sort of spent energy, time, money, effort, research into, you know, building up theories. And recently, I think about 4 or 5 months ago, a very important thinker, Arab thinker, died, passed away, called Jabri, from Morocco, I think, and North Africa, some North African country. He's a major Arab thinker, and, you know, one of the people who've held certain, you know, theories and so on. And he died, he passed away. It was important. But then, you know, a few weeks or months later, someone nobody had ever heard of, a guy who had a degree but couldn't find a job, who had to go and start selling stuff as a street vendor, also in North Africa, in Tunisia, by the name of Abu Aziza. And he gets slapped in the face by a police officer and decides, you know, I'm going to go and burn myself.
Yeah.
And he burns himself, and people forget that this is what actually torched
everything.
Everything. And it's to do with what? It's to do with dignity, with freedom, with ideas that actually are very much part of what human beings are all about. And suddenly, you know, you have this entire major earthquake happening in the Arab world. And still happening. It hasn't stopped. And, you know, just think of the difference. Jabri, a great man, thinker, he sort of comes from a long line of great thinkers trying to put theories together, and nothing works for the Arab world. But then one man comes up and says, dignity, freedom, and he does it by torching himself, and the entire world erupts. So it's a powerful message.
Yes, it is. Something that I think is unusual in your writing, maybe it's not as unusual as I am presuming, is I mentioned this a minute ago. Your relationship with Judaism and with Israelis. I mean, your friendship with Amos Oz. You tell a story in your book about your sister reading the diary of Anne Frank,
mm-hmm.
and being devastated by that.
That's right.
I sense that you, even with all that happened to your family, You were always very attentive to what you found admirable, starting with the kibbutzim in the 60s.
Yes,
and
yes.
Is that unusual, that admiration that you have?
I'm not sure whether it is unusual or not, but it's certainly, I mean, what I mean is this. It's quite possible that many other Palestinian families have actually entertained or had the same kinds of feelings about Jews and neighbors and so on, but maybe without expressing them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in my case, you know,
you write books.
I just say what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the difference. I mean, you know, in my case, I mean, you know, look, my father's one of my father's students. When the British were here, they established a law school, later to become part of the Hebrew University. So today's Hebrew University Law School was established prior to the Hebrew University by the British during the mandatory period. And my father, who at the time had studied law and so on, was actually appointed to give some lectures in this particular school. This was in the mandatory period. My father was appointed, he was a very young judge, he was a judge, appointed as judge and was giving courses. And one of his students, later became a lawyer, an Israeli lawyer, and I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago, was moving house. Suddenly I get a note from him saying, you know, I'm copying to you, or I'm sending you the notes I took from your father's lectures when he was doing this. Now, this is, you know, these are personal immediate familial ties, relations that remind you of the fact that, you know, over and above people being this or that, they're also students, they're also friends, they're also acquaintances. You know, it's not, it's, you cannot separate between the two. And in our case, we just were kept aware of it. And certainly after 67, my father introduced us, me, the daughter that you mentioned who was reading Anne Frank's diary, to friends of his and children of friends of his that he had from prior to 48.
Right.
So, and we still have that kind of relationship.
And so there's that reality, and then, you know, here's something that you wrote that's very present for me being in Jerusalem this week. It's remarkable how sacred sites that can arouse in us, and you were saying this as the call to prayer is sounding, can arouse in us a sense of the ineffable mystery of life, can also spawn a bare-knuckle brawl. You wrote, this is a mystery only a metaphysician or psychotherapist can make any sense of. I won't try, but would you try? Because it's very, it's, you know, it's, it's so strange and dramatic to experience this, the juxtaposition of these things.
You know, there's, I'm not really sure, but there is a kind of, you know, sometimes people use the image of the soul being like a mirror, right? Reflecting the universe, the divine God. And, you know, the mirror can sometimes turn this way and sometimes be turned that way. And, you know, sometimes if it's turned the wrong way, not the right way, it sort of can create problems. If it's turned the right way, it can really reflect, you can really reflect the divinity of life in you. If it's sort of clouded, if it's not clear, if it's turned the other way, this is, by the way, a Sufi image that I'm telling. And maybe this is what lies in the call to prayer and in the sense of the divine, that it can actually be a real call for appreciation of the universe in all of its manifestations. And it can be, on the other hand, a call for, you know, thinking highly only of yourself, of overcoming other people. I just recently came back from a trip to Angkor in Cambodia.
Okay.
And went visiting the temples there. And, you know, one thing that struck me was the four faces in many of the gates that were on those temples of Buddha. And I was asking the guide, you know, what these stood for. And, you know, he said, care, compassion, charity, and equality are the four faces of Buddha in those temples. And, you know, as he said them, you know, I just felt, to me, this is God. Mm. And I'm not a Buddhist.
Right. You have, if we talk about healing, right? I mean, you have, you've said that political divisions scarring the Holy Land begin in the religious imagination, and it is here that they must be combated and overcome. The peace processes don't take that into account.
No. And I'm not sure they can, actually.
No.
It's a problem. And that's why I was saying that, you know, there's only one, the two processes, or more than one layer of processes going on at the same time, or should be going on at the same time. And one of them is the process of negotiations one hears about, where people go to hotel rooms or offices and sit down and negotiate bits and pieces of territory. But the other layers are the layers that have to do with bringing the societies, helping the societies mature, if you like, in this process of maturation we talked about. And this is maybe something one should say, which is that unlike, say, a negotiation that takes place over something totally different, like a legal negotiation over property or prices or what have you, here what you have is a process in which the entire society on one side has to be engaged with the entire society of the other side for the negotiation to, in fact, proceed. It can't be only engaged in by a few experts or lawyers or, you know, very clever politicians behind closed doors. Everyone has to be somehow brought in. And they have to be brought in, buy into what is happening, be helped to go along with the process. And this is where maybe addressing people's religious beliefs is important, because it's something that, and it can't be done overnight. It is something that takes time.
So there's been a process. I want to make sure I get this right, that the security wall was coming through playing fields of Al-Quds University, is that right? And you had a successful nonviolent protest. So, I mean, that's an example of the kind of story that you don't hear. It does seem to be unusual also.
It was a wonderful story.
Tell me about that.
But it's something also that you have to take into account here, the fact that the United States interfered. And this is very, very telling. That's very important. Because at the end of the day, what happened was that the time Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, called in the Defense Ministry's director and told him, look, all right, we agree with you, with Israel, that you have to build a wall for your security purposes, but we also have to make sure that the security fence does not impinge on the life or rights of your neighbors. And this is a case where there seems to be a problem, where you're trying to build up a wall right in the middle of a playing field. So, you know, you have to get this fixed. And so he came back from his trip to the United States, and we were sitting in one of the hotel rooms here with his team of engineers and architects and defense experts, and I had my so-called team of people. And he came in and said, look, let's go into the next room. And we went by ourselves to the next room and told me, look, drawing up the map, where do you want this wall built? And so I told him, here, because here you can have a wall, but it does not actually run through my campus. And he came back to his people and said, okay, this is where it is. So we didn't actually spend too much negotiating. Okay. However, in order to get to that point, we spent more than 34 continuous days of sit-in protests on the field. And it was very important for us to do this peacefully. And it was very important for us, as we did this, to also address the other side, in this case Israel, by saying that, you know, okay, regardless of what we think about your idea of setting up a wall, it's your decision, you want to set it up, fine, but it should not be at our expense. You know, set it up so that we are not made to suffer. And then we sat there for, as I say, 34 days. We had our classes there, our meetings, our graduation ceremonies. We had horse racing contests, chess, you name it. But it was constantly a constant presence. And the army that was there at the beginning, right from the beginning, when it saw that we were just going there and doing things peacefully, just withdrew.
Right.
They're a bit worried at the beginning. And we made sure, you know, we told the students that we don't want a martyr here. That, okay, we have a martyr. The next day, you have a headline, martyr at Al-Quds University, but then the university is shut down for 2 months. We come back after 2 months, and the wall is built. So please keep your bravery and courage to one side, and let's keep this going, and let's try to push the wall back. We did.
And maybe it is, again, your sense of time, but I think it could seem devastating to you that there's a wall, even if it's not in the middle of the playing fields. There's a wall around Al-Quds University, the Arabic University in Jerusalem.
I mean, you know, for someone like me, and I was telling people that, as far as I'm concerned, it's a slap in the face, in the sense that there I was preaching to people that we should build bridges with Israelis, and people come to me and say, look at what your Israelis are doing to us. They're not building bridges, they're building building walls. Mm-hmm. And so one has to try and overcome that. And I try to overcome that by again appealing to what I believe to be more important issues, which are, you know, regardless of what the Israelis are doing, we should be better. And regardless of how they perceive things, we should perceive them in more open ways. Of course, you know, it doesn't always work. To try and talk people to people like this. But as far as I'm concerned, at least, you know, I can only be really or feel really strong in my own positions, in the positions I take. And I take many positions that are very controversial. If I feel at the same time that actually in taking them, I'm being true to what I believe are human principles, that constitute what I like to think of myself as. So, and this is what I convey to my students.
And this, in 2003, you founded this People's Voice,
yeah,
a nonpartisan civilian movement, together with the former head of the Israeli Security Agency. I mean, is that an example also of the kind of thing that's happening parallel or...
Well, look, I mean, I mean, we've been doing this kind of thing. I've been engaged in all kinds of activities with Israeli counterparts over the years, in different ways, at different levels. Before this particular initiative with Ami Ayalon, I was, you know, 3-4 years before that, engaged in a very similar initiative with people in the left part of the Israeli establishment, with people like Yossi Beilin and Yossi Sarid and so on. We tried to do something similar, just with the outbreak of this so-called second intifada. We tried to do something similar, which unfortunately didn't work. And then this came along with Ami Ayalon, and I felt that maybe working with him might be more successful than working
with the left.
With the left. Uh-huh. And so I went wholeheartedly with this, and unfortunately, it didn't quite bear the kind of fruit that I wanted, that I hoped for. But, you know, in addition to this kind of political activity that I've been engaged in, you know, we've established, for example, this thing called IPSO, which is the Israel-Palestine Scientific Organization. Mm. And this is an organization which has, in fact, been able to fund and encourage cooperation between many Israeli and Palestinian scientists in joint projects. And this is not something that catches the headlines, that is very important, but it's there. And actually, if you dig deep enough, you'll find that there are many such programs that are going on among Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, that beneath the surface, there's a lot of activity of cooperation that's going on. And, you know, even if it's not significant in itself, it's significant insofar as it reflects the potential that exists, the readiness, the attitude that I already said was there for a real political process. So we're going there, we're getting there, but we're doing it slowly. And very often we make mistakes, unfortunately, as we go along, but you know, it's part of humanity to make those mistakes.
Mm. I think that's your last word. Anything else you'd want to add that I didn't ask you about? Or
I'm always worried when people ask me that.
I think this was wonderful. I want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anything burning that...
Have you always been doing
this
kind of thing?
I lost track of time.
Have you always done this kind of thing?
I've done this for... we've had this program for 7 years.
Well done.
Thank you.
Very impressive.
So we'll put the whole interview on the... online, and then we'll turn this into an hour of radio.
Yeah,
and it will be wonderful for people to hear you. So thank you. I'm so glad we could come here,
fantastic.
Too.
Fantastic. Thank you. Great.
Could you say your name for us?
It's Sari Nusaydi.
And how do you pronounce
Al-Quds? Al-Quds University. Al-Quds.
We have occupied your office, but we left now.
Yeah,
I'm used to being occupied. I was telling people we should use another term for occupation, because when do you use the term occupied? You go to the public laboratory. And you want to go in and say occupied. And if you stand outside thinking about occupied, it will be free in a minute. So you wait. In this case, it's been 40 years.
And you have to go really badly.
You just use another. Anyway, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I imagine you want the office now, right?
Put it back to normal.